the only qualifications for a candidate that really matter. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is my co-host, Vice Chairman, very good friend, fellow analyst, and all-around great human being, Chuck Michaels.
Well, I really appreciate that ringing endorsement. We'll see how great a human being I am and if other people share that opinion.
Well, you know, I think, Chuck, that at least from our perspective in this program, we hopefully have given our listeners a taste of the idea that we believe in original sin. We believe that people aren't inherently good, but through the grace of God and Christ, that they can be brought to a level of being able to be called good, but not in and of themselves, but good because of Christ who's in them.
Oh, absolutely. That is the bottom line. It's all about Christ. It's not about us.
Yes, it is. And you know what? I think that is a very good launching point for our discussion today. You see, ladies and gentlemen in our listening audience, what we want to talk to you about today is criteria for choosing who we will put in authority over us. In our country, in America, we're blessed. We're blessed in so many ways. We are the land of liberty. We are the home of the brave and the land of the free. And part of the reason why is because of the way our founders structured our government. You see, they didn't structure it as a pure democracy where if you can get 50% plus one of people to agree on something, it becomes law at the will of the individual. They didn't give us a meritocracy or a plutocracy or any of those other ocracies. They didn't give us a monarchy where we have a king who we must all bow our knee to. What they gave us was a constitutional representative republic. And what that means, we've talked about before on this program, is that means that we the people ultimately have the ability and the duty to choose individuals from amongst us to act as our governing representatives, to carry out the will of the people who elected them, but not just the will of the people, but the overarching law, rule of law specifically, that undergirds our entire experiment in liberty. Now, Chuck, you know, we are getting into what I like to call the silly season, because this is the point now, even though I know people have been sick and tired of it because it's been going on forever, it seems like, that we are getting ready to make some decisions on choosing someone to carry standards on who will be the next, as they say, leader of the free world or president of the United States. You know, we're going to talk about today the constitutional requirements for presidency, but I think even more than that, I think we need to look at something that's not necessarily spelled out in the Constitution, but was definitely undergirding the philosophy of our founders in relation to having that person who we finally choose in our representative republic to be the commander-in-chief, to be the top official in our governmental structure. There was a criteria, or a set of criteria, I should say, that our founders basically presupposed, because it was an assumption by them and the way they set up the government that these criteria would have to be met in order for an individual to be eligible to be that chief executive.
Well, think in terms of what's the Adams quote? This government was designed for a people who are
for a moral and religious people.
And religious people. It's wholly inadequate for any other.
For the and governance of any other. That's right.
That's thank you. As usual, I don't have the complete quote in my head, but I know the gist. And that's nothing new. Unfortunately, people will find that out as they listen to this show. I generally mess it up. Unless it's right in front of me and I'm reading it.
No, that's okay.
With that statement, you have to understand what they were being guided by. People like Adams, people like Washington, people like even Hamilton, Madison, people like most of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, you know, despite the claims that they were all deists. I think you and I could very easily prove here on this show, if we felt like it, that in fact, most of them were practicing Christians, and about 5% of them may have been considered a quote unquote deist. Not all of them were completely Orthodox. What they were going on was a set of presuppositions, and they were going on a set of character values that they wanted to see for office. And the fact is, if you want to know, it's really not that difficult. If you want to know what those character assumptions were, all you have to do is look at places in the Bible, like 1 Timothy 3, basically verses 1 through 13, and Exodus 18, to see what these guys were going for regarding leadership. Now, 1 Timothy 3 is about qualifications for overseers and deacons in a church.
Correct.
But the modeling of the government was essentially along the same lines. The character they were looking for in individuals was the same for what they were looking for as the overseers or the perhaps you might say elders and deacons of a church. And in fact, if you don't think so, go back to Exodus 18, where basically Moses lays out the qualifications for civil authority, and you'll see that they're virtually identical.
Well, it's funny you happen to mention going to Exodus 18, because as we started this program, I opened my Bible to exactly that passage because I knew we were going to be talking about it during the program. And if I may, I'd like to give us a little bit of a Bible study today because I want to read this little passage for those who may not remember off the top of their heads what's in Exodus 18, and to help people understand not only are these standards that were for rulers in Israel, but they are standards that our founders used as their guiding influence for creating the government we have now. I'm going to start there in Exodus chapter 18, verse 13 and following. And it says, "Now on the morrow, when Moses sat to judge the people stood about Moses from morning unto evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, What is this that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou thyself alone, and all the people stand about thee from morning unto evening? And Moses said unto his father-in-law, Because the people come unto me to seek God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another, and declare the ordinances of God and his laws. But Moses' father-in-law said unto him, The thing which thou doest is not well. Thou both weariest thyself greatly, and this people that is with thee. For the thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to do it thyself alone. Hear now my voice. I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, and report thou the causes unto God, and admonish them of the ordinances and of the laws, and show them the way wherein they must walk, and the work that they must do. Moreover, provide thou among all the people men of courage, fearing God, men dealing truly, hating covetousness, and appoint such over them to be rulers over thousands, rulers over hundreds, rulers over fifties, and rulers over tens. And let them judge the people at all seasons. But every great matter let them bring unto thee, and let them judge all small causes. So shall it be easier for thee when they shall bear the burden with thee. If thou do this thing, and God so command thee, both thou shalt be able to endure, and all this people shall also go quietly to their place." So Moses obeyed the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose men of courage out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers over thousands, rulers over hundreds, rulers over fifties, and rulers over tens. And they judged the people at all seasons, but they brought the hard cases to Moses, for they judged all small matters themselves. Afterward, Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went into his country. And that's the end of Exodus 18. So it was verses 13 through 27, Chuck.
Well, there's an important companion passage to that. And it is in, I believe, in Numbers. I think Numbers chapter 1.
Okay. Okay, Chuck, yeah, I think I found the passage. I think it's actually in Deuteronomy chapter 1.
It is Deuteronomy. I always mess up between Numbers and Deuteronomy in the first chapter for some reason.
That happens, I think, to a lot of folks. But basically what you're looking at, you said it's a companion to what we talked about in Exodus 18. It's Deuteronomy 1, verses 9 through 18. And it basically says, "And I spake unto you the same time, saying, I am not able to bear you myself alone. The Lord your God hath multiplied you, and behold, ye are this day as the stars of heaven in number. The Lord God of your fathers make you 1,000 times so many more as you are, and bless you as he hath promised you. How can I alone bear your cumbrance and your charge and your strife? Bring you men of wisdom and of understanding, and known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. Then he answered me and said, The thing is good that thou hast commanded us to do. So I took the chief of your tribes, wise and known men, and made them rulers over you, captains over thousands, and captains over hundreds, and captains over 50, and captains over 10, and officers among your tribes. And I charged your judges that same time, saying, Hear the controversies between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother and the stranger that is with him. Ye shall have no respect of person in judgment, but shall hear the small as well as the great. Ye shall not fear the face of man, for the judgment is God's, and the cause that is too hard for you, bring unto me, and I will hear it. Also I commanded you the same time all the things which ye should do." That's Deuteronomy 1, verses 9 through 18. And Chuck, there's such a wealth of thought in here about the fact that, and you, I think you mentioned earlier, that what Moses was saying is that the people actually chose those men of courage.
Verse 13.
As Exodus says, men of wisdom and of understanding and known among your tribe. So in other words,
yep,
these were people who their character had set them above and beyond as leaders. And because you think about those qualifications from Exodus 18, that you men of courage, fearing God, loving the truth, and hating covetousness, which basically is being able to be bribed. They're not able to be bribed. Oh, but we had men today like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Now, you bring that point up. Let's go over real quick to 1 Timothy 3. In some Bibles, the heading might say qualifications for elders. Some but says overseers. Virtually the same office. Okay, here it is. Verses 1 through 7. The saying is trustworthy. If anyone aspires to the office of overseer, he desires a noble task. Therefore, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I think that's men who love truth and hate, love, fear God, love truth, hate covetousness, and are men of courage. Men who have wisdom and understanding. Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Now, here's some more of his character. These are important things, and we're going to probably expand on these as we go. He must manage his own household well with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? And, concomitantly, this is not in the text, but since we have a jurisdictional separation between church and state, in other words, God has leaders for church and leaders for state, how could someone also care for God's civil government? Because at the bottom line, it is God's civil government.
You're exactly right, Chuck. And that was the one thing I was going to bring up to our listeners is I'm sure that probably we're going to get some emails and basically saying, well, that New Testament passage is only talking about the church leaders, and that Old Testament stuff was talking about the civil authorities, and those two are entirely different. But I
and
think
as we
that,
can see,
but I think Paul answers that question for us as to why those two things work together in Romans 13.
Yes, absolutely. That's right. The civil authority or the civil magistrate is a minister for our good who wields the sword not in vain, but to punish evildoers and to reward good.
As a matter of fact, I believe Paul uses that phrase, minister of God, in referring to civil authorities. You know, or they talk about the higher powers in Romans 13. And a lot of people believe that that means that, okay, anybody who's in office is there and we must obey them in everything. But we can talk about it on another program about how you define Romans 13. But basically says that their magistrates are not to be feared for good works, but for evil. Wilt thou then be without fear of the power? Do well, so thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God for thy will. Now it says it once in verse 4, and then it keeps going on, and it basically says, but he is the minister of God, twice in verse 4, and then for they are God's ministers, applying themselves for the same thing in verse 6. So three different times in Romans 13, in the first six verses, Paul references civil authorities as ministers of God who are there for your wealth, to bear the sword, to take vengeance on him that does evil, and applying themselves for your good. Now, this is the whole situation there, Chuck, that is the tie-in, because in order for them to do good, that means that they must fear God and obey his commandments. Because good and evil, as defined, are not subject to the definition of the civil magistrate himself in his own wisdom. There's an absolute truth standard to what is considered good and what is considered evil. We see what happens in cultures where men are left to their own reason and divorced from God and defining good and evil. Innocent children are slaughtered in the womb. Elderly people's lives are snuffed out because they said that they're not of a value to the society anymore. Or in what the 20th century showed with many leaders was that mass genocide of their own people took place because man put himself in place of God and decided to rule based on what man decided through his own darkened mind was good and evil.
It's natural law coupled with human reason, and unfortunately, with human reason being tainted as it is by the fall, it can do all kinds of nasty things to quote-unquote natural law. Not to get too deep into the philosophy of what natural law is, but it's essentially the law written on men's hearts. You know, there are no societies where murder is acceptable, where kidnapping is acceptable, where stealing is acceptable. There are different variations of socialized economies and that kind of thing, and all through a different spectrum and in tribal places, but they all have sort of this general law that can't be violated, and it's part of that law written on men's hearts. And unfortunately, what happens with a lot of natural law advocates is it can only go so far. And as we know, our founding fathers went back not just to natural law, but to revealed law as well. And they stated so openly. In fact, they basically used Blackstone as a reference. And Blackstone was very clear about what the basis of law was. He defined the term the law of nature and of nature's God. And the law of nature was that natural law component, but the law of nature's God was the revealed law component. And that revealed law is the law that's contained in scriptures. And you and I went to a meeting in Columbus in July, mm-hmm. the We the People rally, where someone from a large foundation was basically, despite having been corrected on several by several different people, went on expounding about how the law of nature's God was essentially the law of the Greeks. And I'm like, well, I was unaware that the Greeks had created the world. The statement was nonsensical. And of course, people came to us and asked us, and we said, well, no, that's all you have to do is read Blackstone to find out where that phrase came from. And Blackstone's very clear about what it means.
That's right. That's absolutely true.
So even though it seems like we've gotten far afield in this discussion, we haven't. because it's all about the limits of the civil magistrate and what his worldview is supposed to be. And the founding fathers did have a view of the worldview of the civil magistrate they hoped would hold the office, and it was not an atheist. In fact, many people don't realize that Thomas Jefferson was run through the ringer because he was not an Orthodox Christian when he ran for president. All kinds of things were said about him that most of them grossly exaggerated, but it had to do with the fact that he was not an Orthodox. He did not have an Orthodox view of Jesus Christ as the Son of God. He was more of a sort of a proto-Unitarian who thought Christ was a great teacher and philosopher, a modern day liberal theologian, if you will. And people were certain that this was correct. Going to mean that he would be a terrible president. And the fact is that Thomas Jefferson ended up being a fairly decent president, but he also had, despite the fact that he was not an Orthodox Christian, he had been raised at the feet of Christians, and he had what amounted to a Christian worldview. Our good friend John Lofton always has sort of said half facetiously that the 18th century had a better class of atheists than we do. And we laugh, but it's also true because they were all brought up with Christian teachers. Now we've got a problem in that our Christian kids are being brought up by atheist and agnostic teachers. And guess what? They're not coming out with a Christian worldview.
That's true. Well, and those numbers are somewhat staggering when you take a look at those things. But, you know, when we get back around to it, when we're dealing with a fact that now, when we are in the midst of the silly season, as I called it earlier, of choosing someone to be president and be the chief executive over all of us, I think we have to tighten down and look at our thinking. Look at the rationales for why we choose the people we choose to serve and see if they line up clearly, especially for we who call ourselves believers upon Christ Jesus, if they line up clearly with the truth biblical admonitions for the minimum standards of qualification for that leadership. And Chuck, I guess my feeling on this is that we've done a pretty woeful job, and really I'm not sure if, because I hear a lot today from many Christians, including Christian leaders in our society, the quick, almost snap judgment endorsement of individuals based upon factors that I don't think we find in God's Word. I don't see electability in there unless you want to try to say that the section that when the people choose someone that they're known among the tribes, that means electability. I'm not so sure that equates there in relation to what that's specifically saying there in Deuteronomy 1. But that seems to be a key priority for many, including many believers, when they're looking at the candidates who are on display, I guess is the best way to put it, and who are vying to get people's support in their votes. Do you see that any differently, or is that how you look at it as well?
One thing I'll take you to task for is you said you feel, and I don't think you feel it at all. I think you think it.
I think you're right. I would take it to task by my class for saying that too.
Yeah, we don't allow people in our class to say, I don't care what you feel, I want to know what you think.
That's it.
you go home and feel all you want, but here you think. That being said, you and I have been friends through about what now? 2.5 presidential cycles, I think. We worked together in campaigns on 04, 06, 08, 10.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And everything in between on different issues.
That's right.
And it never fails that Christians are not very good strategists. They may be good at Chinese checkers, but they're really terrible at chess because they can't see the whole board. Now, I'm no master whiz at chess, but I can think in terms of the whole board. And by that, what I mean is, very often they get themselves maneuvered into saying, I choose this guy for a couple of reasons. One, he's not the other guy who's completely beyond the pale, but he's the dangerous guy we got to beat. This is within a party situation, okay? Let's just pick a party, the Republicrats.
Okay,
we've got this one Republican who's more like a Democrat, and we can't have that. So what we do is we pick this other guy who has a reputation for being a better Republican, despite the fact that he really is a lousy one. He doesn't hold with any of the party philosophy, but he's not that other guy who's really bad. And he's also electable. And that's what really, we can't stand four more years of the Democrat.
True. Yeah, I've heard that quite a
we
bit.
We can't
as well.
Stand for, yes, we can't stand four more years. We're all going to die. You know, the world's going to come to an end and a comet's going to hit us and we're all going to die a horrible, fiery death if this guy's reelected. So, therefore, we've got to find somebody who's electable and someone who isn't this other guy. So, Christians constantly find themselves being triangulated into accepting people who simply. At any other time, there's an old saying, would you leave your daughter alone with this person or your son alone with this person for any length of time? Would you leave the house with them there? And the answer in very many cases is no. And yet they would elect them to be to hold some high office, president or senate or the Congress or state representative or state senator or governor. We've seen it over and over and over again. And basically, I have been beaten up verbally, not physically, but beaten up, mauled around, called names, marginalized because I pointed out these people's records. I said, just examine the record.
And when we're dealing the higher and the more important of the office, the more likely that person's going to have a record of where they voted. Now, you know, Chuck, you know, I've been involved in legislative issues and working around governments now for almost two decades. The other thing is they do have a record. We have to be careful to parse that record carefully because there are a number of times that people will advance to higher and higher offices because they're hiding behind their party leadership and they just vote the way that leadership tells them to vote. It's not what they truly believe, but then you can find out what these people truly believe by matching up how they vote and their public statements and how they've answered various group surveys. Like if you have one Christian group here and they answer it one way, and then you have a secular business group over here and they're answering it another way, you know that somebody's not getting the truth.
Well, as you and I both know, sometimes certain groups' questionnaires, and we won't name names, but certain groups' questionnaires are written in such a way as to make certain candidates appear better than they actually are.
Yeah, I've seen that happen as well. That's what I think I call mission creep, where you forget what the mission is to inform people of what the candidates truly are, what they truly believe. And you start trying to, well, as we say on this program, pick winners and losers ahead of time because it fits a preconceived notion of party X is better than party Y and party
right.
Y is in control and we have to get party X in the driver's seat. Problem is the car is still careening toward the edge of the cliff and the car happens to hold our children, our families, our businesses, and it doesn't matter who's in the driver's seat. They both have their foot pressed firmly on the gas pedal all the way to the floor.
Well, as you and I both know, in just this the decade before this one, there was a single party control of two houses at one point. And in fact, the federal Leviathan grew at the same rate, if not faster, than it had under the other parties, single party control of the both houses and the presidency. So it really, it ends up when you've got a situation where it doesn't really matter which party is in control, the mess keeps getting deeper and worse, then you've got something else going on. And we need to figure out what that is. And I think we've touched on it with this character issue. We've got people taking oaths and swearing to uphold, defend, and protect the Constitution of their states and of the United States of America. And they are, in fact, can be shown openly to be liars. They are not defending, protecting, and upholding. They are tearing down, ignoring, and folding, spindling, and mutilating. And it's a character issue. And they get away with it because they know that at election time, they'll play that triangulation game. The party will very often, if there is a challenger, the party will pull out all the stops. If he's a truly a principled person, but he's against what the party wants to do, then they will pull out all the stops, spend every dime they have, lie, cheat, break the law to get that candidate defeated. We've seen that how many times?
More than I'd like to count.
Yeah. And in fact, if you bring it up, everybody just sort of shrugs their shoulders and say, well, that's how things get done. Well, a business as usual is the reason we're in this mess now. So we need people to start thinking A, long term, and B, biblically about civil government. And absolutely. I know we're going to get pilloried for that. Well, you know, government, the separation of church and state. Yes, there is a jurisdictional separation between church and state.
But there's not an ethical separation.
That's right.
Between the qualifications and the character of the people that you put in place to be the leaders in both jurisdictions.
And if they have no moral roadmap regarding issues like gambling and pornography and drugs,
abortion and drug use, and yes.
It really doesn't matter what their economic program is if they're going to allow the moral condition slide. All you have to do, it's interesting now, I was reading a story, as we've mentioned here before, I'm a former Michigan resident. I lived in Michigan for 11 years. And while I was there, there was a big deal about they were going to save the city of Detroit by bringing in gambling casinos. So Detroit now has several gambling casinos. I think they're essentially the Indians in the area were allowed to buy up land, have it converted to a reservation, and then put casinos on there. And this was going to save the city of Detroit. Well, the city of Detroit is now trying to stave off impending bankruptcy by running a Detroit-only lottery. Well, I think you and I know where that's headed. That is, not only will Detroit not avoid bankruptcy, but Detroit will slide further into the abyss of family breakdown, bankruptcy, both personal and civil, and the complete moral decay that it can be shown. If anybody's been to Detroit lately, it is not a nice place. And my mother was raised in Detroit, and it used to be. It's never been a beautiful city, but it was certainly a very livable city. And I know a lot of people who were raised in the same neighborhood as my mother in the 1930s and 40s and early 50s. And it was a very livable city. It was a very middle-class city. It was a city that where there were jobs, and it has really, really fallen on hard times. And it's for this reason. It has not had anyone with any kind of a moral outlook or moral framework in charge of it for 40-plus years. And so we sowed the wind there, and now we reap the whirlwind.
And it's all because of character. Now, you mentioned a little earlier that justification that oftentimes people will pick someone because, well, they're good on the economy. And you know, we've heard since the 90s, it's the economy, stupid. It's, you know, it's all about the economy. A man's personal life doesn't matter. Well, you know, only unless it becomes like extremely egregious. Does it ever rise to the level of care of the electorate to become incensed or enraged? And we can think back to the impeachment of President Clinton and others, and we can go through a long litany of laundry lists of U.S. senators and representatives who have resigned in disgrace over moral turpitude issues. But when it really gets right down to it, honestly, we the people are responsible for those problems happening in the first place because of not taking care and diligence to look well to the character of the men that we're electing to office before we give them the authority by putting them into the office, voting them into their job, and paying them their paycheck through our taxes. It's interesting because, you know what, there's a situation that at one point in our culture's history, the clergy of the churches took great care to make sure that their congregants looked well to the character and the qualifications of those people that they elect into office. I don't know how many times we've heard now or seen of these in these situations. We hear, it seems like every election cycle, you know, some group like the Alliance Defense Fund or everybody else, they want pastors to speak out into the pulpit about candidates. Well, you know what? I don't think it should take a legal defense team and a handful of pastors in churches around the country who are willing to, quote unquote, make a case out of it and only happen during election time. But this should be something that, as the churches are vibrant and Bible-believing and filled with the Scripture, should look well to during all times of the year, and possibly even to looking toward those leaders, because if you think about the Exodus and the Deuteronomy passages, these were supposed to have been leaders in their own tribes, as it said, which meant in their own communities, in their homes and their families, you know, the leaders in their families, the leaders in their communities. Those are the people who would be the ones chosen for those civic leadership positions.
Well, I think you and I both have a copy of a book by Ella Sandoz, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, we do.
It's called Election Day Sermons of the Founding Era.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's a great resource for people if they wanted to look at that. We also have one in our principled policy catalog. You can find it on our website at principledpolicy.com. Go to our bookstore. We have one called Election Day Sermon.
Yep.
That is a really good book. It's short, and it's some modern and some historic sermons that are preached around the reasons why believers need to look to the character of their rulers or those men that they're going to put in offices. That we can't just say, well, because this person is of the party that's not in power right now, and we think they'll do a better job. That shouldn't be our qualification as believers. Our qualification should come from God's word and should be guided and informed by that word. Now, granted, yes, Chuck, let's not also slip into the situation, and I think you mentioned this earlier, of believing that one particular political party is more holy than another political party.
Right.
And you know, and we're strictly nonpartisan's not the right word. We're strictly very partisan in the Institute for Principled Policy. We're partisan toward God. We're partisan toward the Bible and God's word. So that means that no political party, temporal political party, carries our allegiance more than any other. So we don't sit here and believe that GOP stands for God's own party, or that Democrats are Democrats. I've heard that, you know,
I've heard demon rats and all kinds of things. That's all nonsense. I mean, the party label, it's supposed to mean something, but it doesn't, as we've stated here on several occasions.
That's it.
And as far as we will be happy to beat on candidates in an equal opportunity fashion. If they don't meet the criteria, then they will get criticized, period. And there are, believe me, there on both sides of the ballot this year, there is plenty to criticize.
Yes, and you know, we could probably go into talking about the various peccadilloes of pretty much all of the candidates who are running for office, whether it be from the president of the United States and a number of the character issues that surround that individual, or whether it be any of those who are right now running for nomination on the ticket for the Republican Party. And, you know, every day you see in the news where one and another, then, you know, one scandal has come up or one shortcoming has been made known, or their positions have gone like have been blowing in the wind. And at one point in their life, they were here. And the next point of their life, they're here. And those points are really not that far apart, to think that it's actually a change in their character, rather than it's a change in the political strategy that they're using to try to get nominated.
Well, I think you and I laughed the other day because I'd said that, one particular candidate had switched positions so many times and so fast that I called him a political chameleon, but I said he looks plaid.
That's right.
That's how quickly he changes positions and stories and where he stands on issues. You know, you can pull up films and other people have done it and cut them together where he has taken every position on the compass on a given issue. And so where does he stand now? This is a man who has very little character, if any. I mean, I think maybe we ought to define what we mean by character, and I'm going to get the Webster's 1828 dictionary out. You know, you look at modern dictionaries that purport to be decent dictionaries of the English language, and they just really don't hold a candle to the old Webster's 1828 dictionary. Folks, if you want to know what the Constitution, what the words in the Constitution mean, get yourself or go online or get a copy of Webster's 1828 dictionary. It costs about $60. It is well worth the investment. Here is the definition of character. Now, there are a couple of them that fit in about what we're talking about. One of them is the fourth definition of the word, and that is the peculiar qualities impressed by nature or habit on a person which distinguish him from others. These constitute real character, and the qualities which he is supposed to possess constitute his estimated character or reputation. Hence we say a character is not formed when the person has not acquired stable and distinctive qualities. I think that's an incredibly important, stable quality.
Yes.
Well, one of the qualities of one of the things about having a stable character is the fact that you don't flip flop on issues. Now, it's one thing to go in and state a position on an issue and get deeper into it and say, you know, I've changed my mind on that. That is a sign of character. And you come out and you admit, I was wrong before. I think I have a much better position now. I have no problem with that.
Oh, I don't. I don't admire. Either. That actually is a sign of humility, which is actually a character quality that you want in a leader.
That isn't. Yeah, exactly. That is a desirable quality. Okay, I was wrong before. I think I'm on the road. You know, nobody ever says I'm absolutely correct now. And that's a character flaw as well. All right, there's another one here. There's number 8. Oh, no, number 7 and number 8. Let's look at number 7. By way of eminence, distinguish or good qualities, those which are esteemed and respected, and those which are ascribed to a person in common estimation. We inquire whether a stranger is a man of character. Well, that's a question that's almost completely missing in modern discourse. Number 8. Adventitious qualities impressed by office or station, the qualities that, in public estimation, belong to a person in a particular station, as when we ask how a magistrate or commander supports his character. Isn't that an interesting definition?
It is.
So, basically, one of the things we've lost in modern society, and we've been really losing it for, oh gosh, rapidly approaching 2 centuries. I mean, our decline did not start suddenly in 1932 or some other arbitrary date. We have really been in decline since probably about 1820 or so.
Okay.
And it has to do with how people began to view the Constitution and what government was supposed to be about, and the struggle between thinking in Republican terms, small r, and Democratic terms, small d, not party. But once people began to, you know, there's the old saying, and nobody's knows for sure who said it. There are several candidates for the office, but that American government will be fine until people discover that they can vote themselves largesse from the treasury.
Yes, yes.
And that is the epitome of democratic thinking. We're basically going to use the power of government to rob everyone around. You know, anybody who's got more than we have, we should have a piece of that, and therefore we're going to use the power of government to take it.
Right. I believe that was de Tocqueville who said that in one of his writings.
Well, de Tocqueville's been blamed for that. I don't think he said it.
Okay, well,
we'll have to look
that one up.
We'll have to look that one up. It doesn't really matter. You get the it's the character issue that's involved.
Exactly.
That well, and
speaking of the character issue, and since you brought up the Webster's 1828 definition of the word character, I think it would be instructive as well. You know, Noah Webster wasn't very silent on these issues. As one of the founding era folks and involved in government, Noah Webster spoke out. And really, when he spoke out to the people to tell them as to what they were doing that was a problem in relation to choosing candidates. And he said, basically, as he was looking at this, he said it's to the neglect of this rule of conduct in our citizens. And what he was talking about was them not selecting godly men for office, not following God's word in how they chose those people to rule over them. Now, this is Noah Webster, remind you, whose definition of character we just heard. He basically said that it's to the neglect of this rule of conduct in our citizens that we must ascribe the multiplied frauds, the breaches of trust, peculations. I almost thought it said speculations, but it says peculations.
Right.
And embezzlements of public property, which astonish even ourselves, which tarnish the character of our country, and which disgrace a Republican government. And he said, when a citizen gives his vote to a man of known immorality, he abuses his trust or civic responsibility. He sacrifices not only his own interest, but that of his neighbor, and he betrays the interest of his country.
But he's good on the economy.
See, but that wasn't, but no, again, if you elect a man of known immorality, in other words, if his character isn't, as you said, sturdy, if he's willing to flip-flop or he's willing to say that morals only matter in private, i.e., it's the economy, stupid, then
that's right.
Then we have nobody to blame but ourselves when all of these things start falling apart around us in our government. When we see backroom deals and special favors and tax dollars being given out to campaign contributors, to people having moral impropriety and marital infidelities within their offices or with staff people. The lists go on and on. Those who can be bribed. I mean, if you remember the Abscam back in the late 70s and early 80s.
That's right. Yep.
Where members were taking tens of thousands of dollars to swing their votes. And of course, you know, we responded by increasing the ethics. Well, it isn't so much the ethics rules of the chambers that's important. It's the ethical character and conduct, i.e. the character of the individual that the voters put into office, that's important. Because no external rule of man is going to be able to compete with those passions of a defective character.
Well, it's interesting that you use that word peculation, and then we talked about these public character issues. Because here's what the word peculation means.
Okay.
The act, practice, or crime of defrauding the public by appropriating to one's own use the money or goods entrusted to one's care for management or disbursement, embezzlement of public money or goods.
Oh, we've seen that happen quite a bit.
Well, we even see it. We've even gotten so insensitive to this that we forget that when the government basically taxes us through inflation, they have misappropriated our money for their own advancement.
That's right. That's exactly it. When they basically take your tax dollars and hand them off into whomever they decide is a benefactor of them, whether it be a big donor to the party structure or a personal campaign donor, or maybe it's people that, you know, opened doors for them as they were coming up the ladder in political office. You know, that's just, it's wrong. It's fraud is what it is. But those things only come to light when people finally start seeing, when things start falling apart. I mean, we wouldn't have known anything about the deals with the Solyndra and how, and the $500 million of taxpayer money given to this company, which is now vanished, if it hadn't been for the fact that they couldn't meet their deadlines and they couldn't meet their promises, and people had to start investigating. But the, still, the thing is that we have to make sure that the people we put into office are not going to continue to play the same games that have been played by those whose lack of character and who have come before them have set the bar so low or totally eradicated the moral and ethical standards that we would expect out of elected officials.
Well, and we certainly aren't going to get there by sitting here and taking a look at getting into that triangulation situation and saying, well, we're going to have to go with this guy because he's not the other guy. Basically, that's the old voting for the lesser of two evils idea. And as you and I have pointed out for years, when you vote for the lesser of two evils, you voted for evil.
That's right.
That tends to get under people's skin, and they call you silly, and they, you know, they say you don't really care. And then within 6 months of electing this person, very often they will actually get this person elected that they supported and chose. And usually within 6 months to a year, they come to you crying because they say, you know, he's doing this and he's doing that, or she's doing this and she's doing that, and she's doing another thing. She's basically governing like the person who sat in the office before, and we're like, what did you expect? I know you and I have both come to people, and very often they'll say, you know, you were right on that. And then the next time around on the next cycle, the same people are fighting you in the same meetings over somebody who's exactly the same character as the person that they were crying about. And you and I know we both sort of walk out frustrated. And if we weren't both Christians who knew that God was in control and had his hand completely on the switch, we'd be just frustrated beyond belief. But it's all obviously part of his plan. And so we aren't always victorious, but that's the way it works.
Well, God doesn't ask us to be successful. He asks us and directs us. I shouldn't say he asks us, but he directs us to be faithful. He directs us to follow his standards. And even when we're choosing those who are going to be those Romans 13 ministers of God, if we use any other standard other than the clear standard that God lays out in his word for the reasons why we choose an individual or we give our support, because you know what? Your franchise, your vote, that's a sacred duty. It's a civic duty. But it's also one that, you know, God has given to us through the structure that our founders put together in looking at passages like Exodus 18 and Deuteronomy 1. As a matter of fact, you know, the study that was done to show the influence on the founders and where their influences came from and how they structured this government, the number one single largest source of quotes and thoughts in their writings was from God's word, and the largest single source in the Bible for that was the book of Deuteronomy, the book of the law, Deuteronomy 1 sets it up so very clearly. So,
well, if you're writing the highest law of the land, where do you go? You go to God's law to find out how to write the law for a land. Obviously, Deuteronomy, second law, would be a place where you might want to go to. And the beauty about Deuteronomy is, a lot of the law in the Old Testament is kind of spread around a little bit in Exodus and Leviticus, but Deuteronomy is a reiteration, and it's all in a nice compact form.
Yep, exactly. So when we go to make those choices, now in Ohio here, we're not sure when that primary is going to be for many of these people. It could be in March, it could be in April, it could be in May, it could be in June, because our state elected officials are having a little character crisis of their own in determining when to create these primaries or to set the dates for these primaries in this state because of the apportionment that happens every 10 years. But,
well, I don't know if you've heard the word on the street is a single primary in April.
I think that they're trying to get down to a single, although I don't believe that there's honestly been a vote yet to coalesce that. There's still bickering and feelings going back and forth among the two parties on what kind of advantages they can give each other. or get free themselves in order to do this. So, but the point is, the people of Ohio, and includes our listeners and our audience, are going to be going to the polls to make a choice. Primary. Now, in a Republican primary, there's about a dozen individuals right now who are jockeying around for your vote in the primary. Probably what we're going to do here, Chuck, and again, in a very partisan way, and that's partisan toward God's word and its truth, we're probably going to analyze each of these candidates over the next few weeks and discuss the pros and cons from a biblical perspective, from that perspective of Exodus 18, Romans 13, Deuteronomy 1, and Timothy and Titus viewpoint on these individuals for office. And if you vote in the Democratic primary, you may or may not have a primary for president, because right now it's very unclear, with a very low popularity rating, if there won't be a potential challenge to the sitting president, although I doubt there will be, coming from some point in the Democratic Party. And so we would strongly encourage, and we will talk about the president and any other challengers who may arise as well, but we want to make sure.
Believe it or not.
Yeah, go ahead.
Believe it or not, I think there is a Democratic challenger, although I think he's gotten zero traction.
Okay, well, that's probably the case. But anyhow, we're going to analyze all that, because we want our listeners to go to the ballot and make an informed choice, not a choice made out of fear. Okay, this guy's horrible and he's doing bad things, and so therefore we've just got to get him out of office. And not making choices based out of ignorance. Well, I really didn't know that about this guy, and so everything else I heard about him sounded good, so therefore I voted for him. We want to kind of look at it from a biblical perspective, and lay out the cases, because your vote is a sacred duty. It is part of your tithe, ladies and gentlemen, because you are basically, as in a constitutional representative republic, formed from the basis of God's clear standards and his word, you have a duty to bring those people forward, but you have to pick people who meet those qualifications. Now, we can blame the system all we want to say, well, the candidates we've got here are just no good and blah, 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 but we got to pick somebody. That's not God's standard for choosing rulers. And each of us is going to have to give account on the day of judgment for every thought, word, and deed, including our choices for those we elected into office or we gave a vote to help them move on to a general election from a primary. Folks, we need to take our voting just as seriously as we take other aspects of our Christian walk, because it all does matter to God and it all works together for his purposes, but he calls us to be faithful.
Well, we are out of time. If you would like to hear this program or any of the programs we've recorded in the past, join us at www.principledpolicy.com, where you can find archives of these programs. You can also read policy articles and comment. Barry and I invite you to come out to www.principledpolicy.com. And if you enjoy this show, or if you hate this show, or if you just have a question or want to make a comment on this show or any of the other shows that we've made in the past, join us at www.principledpolicy.com. If you enjoy this show, we ask that you prayerfully consider leaving a donation. Thank you for being with us today on Principles and Policies. We ask you to join us again on Monday at 5:30 p.m., where we are going to talk to you again for 15 minutes. And again, all next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and again next Saturday. So be with us at 5:30 on Monday through Friday for Principles and Policies. Thank you. And now, here's a constitutional moment with the Institute on the Constitution's Michael Perutka.
Regarding politics and government, shouldn't we ask, what does a conservative conserve? Well, let's talk about it. As liberals move farther and farther to the left, do conservatives balance this view by moving farther to the right? History shows us that this is not the case. What conservatives invariably do is to follow liberal philosophy in exactly the same direction, just slightly behind it. This is really nothing new. Robert L. Dabney, a well-known 19th century theologian and philosopher, said this:
conservatism never conserves anything. Its history has been that it demurs to each aggression of the liberal party and aims to save its credit by a respectable amount of growling, but always acquiesces at last in the innovation. American conservatism is merely the shadow that follows radicalism as it moves forward towards perdition. It remains behind it, but never retards it, and always advances near its leader. It is worthless because it is the conservatism of expediency only and not of sturdy principle.
Was Dabney onto something here? If conservatives do not like liberal policies, then why do they keep adopting them? If you're just conserving yesterday's liberalism, then maybe conservatism belongs in exile. Constitutionalism might be a better idea. This is Michael Anthony Peruca for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you the American View.